and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, cyber threats. Visiting technology consultant Lawrence Husick talks with the Alaska World Affairs Council about cyberspace as the new strategic battleground. Husick brings his background in intellectual property law to the discussion on technology's importance in international relations, war, and terrorism. His talk was recorded on Friday, May 1st, at the Hilton Anchorage. Husick references a PowerPoint presentation throughout the talk. If you want to follow along, you can find it on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just scroll down and look for the Addressing Alaskans icon in the middle of the page. Garrett Wong of the Alaska World Affairs Council starts us off by introducing today's speaker, Lawrence Husick.
Mr. Husick is a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and a co-director of its Center for Study of Terrorism. Here, he applies his knowledge to the study of terrorist tactics and counterterrorism strategies. He also co-directs the Institute's Watchman Center program on innovation. Mr. Husick is a partner at Lipton, Weinberger & Husick, an intellectual property law firm located in Malvern, Pennsylvania. He is an adjunct faculty member at the Johns Hopkins University in the Whiting Graduate School of Engineering. And if that wasn't enough to fill his calendar, he is a co-founder of several entrepreneurial ventures, including Infonautics, PocketDoctor.com, and Cloud Pharmaceuticals, Inc. Mr. Husick is a founding board member of the Quantum Cures Foundation. And the purpose of that foundation is to design new vaccines, treatments, and cures to address rare and neglected diseases. Today, Mr. Husick is going to share his perspective on cyber threats, the new strategic battleground. Please help me extend a very warm Alaska welcome to Mr. Husick.
Thank you very much for that warm introduction. I'm going to do something that no speaker should ever do. I'm going to duck down behind the podium and swap laptops. Wow, the technology works. Thanks for putting up with that. I'm very, very pleased to be here in Anchorage to speak with you today. I really value the opportunity to travel around the country and around the world talking about this very important issue. And what I hope to do in the next few minutes is outline for you the nature of the threats that we face and the need for some concerted action in ways that might be pretty unexpected. To begin, I should point out that the question of cyber threat is not a new one. And in fact, back in 1999, our Defense Department gave testimony in Congress in which a Deputy Secretary of Defense told us that we would soon face a cyber or electronic Pearl Harbor. And what he pointed out quite presciently was that the target of that Pearl Harbor style attack would not be a military base, but it would be our very economic infrastructure by which we run the country. Now, we should have taken that seriously. And if we needed any more information, we got that information courtesy of two colonels in the People's Liberation Army, who thoughtfully published a book in English in 1999 called Unrestricted Warfare. If you're interested, you can buy your very own copy on Amazon.com, in which they told us specifically that in case of war, China would use cyber war against the United States, and they detailed the mechanisms of such war. Under a Department of Defense doctrine with the unequaled acronym of MUTWA, military operations other than war. Our difficulty is that although they spelled it out in black and white, the United States and China did not necessarily share the same definition of war. And it turns out that we have been at cyber war with China ever since. We just haven't known it. Now, the problem that we face is that there is no agreed upon definition of what cyber war really is. The experts go back and forth, but essentially there are so many ways in which computing systems and networks can be made to go wrong that having a concise definition of the problem is very difficult. But one thing that we know about cyber threats is that there is no effective deterrence to cyber threat, to cyber attack. And without deterrence, we're left wondering, how do we prevent the next attack? Well, to make this concrete, let me point out that a great many of our cyber losses have come from one place, this building in the Pudong district of Shanghai, which is home to a unit of the People's Liberation Army. Security firms have traced a great many cyber attacks over at least 8 years, an attack called the APT, the Advanced Persistent Threat, to this very building. Over 3,000 different organizations have been targeted by this operation. In one case, the Chinese were able to steal over 6.5 terabytes of data from a network without anyone noticing. If you want to know the impact of this, take a look at the appearance of the latest Chinese stealth fighter. It looks remarkably like the US F-22. And this is because the Chinese managed to infiltrate the networks of, among others, Lockheed Martin, the builder of the F-22. And so the advanced persistent threat has been traced directly here. And when faced with this accusation, the Chinese Ministry of Defense responded in the following three ways. The first is that just because you could trace our network address to that building doesn't mean you have technical proof it was us. The second is there isn't any agreed upon definition that this is an attack. And the third is everybody does this anyway. Now, it just so happens that the third rang especially true, because on the very weekend that President Obama was supposed to visit with the President of China to lodge this complaint about the Chinese behavior, Mr. Snowden divulged his information in Hong Kong, telling us that, if anything, our National Security Agency has done it longer and better than the Chinese and to everyone else. So let's step back for a moment and consider the nature of the cyber threats that we face, because the headlines tend to be a little confusing. For instance, we often hear about these things, these cyber threats, as cyber crime, cyber spying, cyber war, cyber terrorism, cyber espionage, you name it. The important thing to remember is that all of these things are essentially the same. They use the same tools and techniques. What differs is the objective, just the objective. You see, for cybercrime, the objective is money. It's your credit card number. It's your bank account. It's targets' databases. For cyberespionage, the objective is the data. How much information can we exfiltrate from a computer system and network? And for cyber war and cyber terror, the objective is disruption. Disruption of how we do business, disruption of how we conduct policy. And this leaves us with an interesting strategic stance. During the Cold War, I think all of you recognize that the United States had a doctrine called MAD, appropriately named. It was mutually assured destruction. That meant that although the Soviet Union might succeed in launching a first strike, we would retain enough retaliatory capacity to barbecue the planet. And in this way, created a standoff that stood the test of time and lasted more than 60 years until the fall of the Soviet Union. Today, however, we face a different strategic conundrum, and we call it mud. Both because it's clear as mud and because our stance is multilateral, unconstrained disruption. Multilateral because we're no longer worried about one adversary superpower. Today, it's nation states, it's state-supported actors, it's independent terrorist groups, it's teenagers sitting in their parents' basement. Unconstrained because the targets are no longer military or purely economic, They're everything and everywhere, from the smartphone in your pocket to the PC on your desk to the controllers that control the flow of oil through the Alaska pipeline. And disruption, because the military doctrine doesn't call for outright destruction of the enemy, but just enough disruption to cause a change in either political or military course. This is truly a confusing situation. Now, it's made all the more confusing because the computers you see, although their security is at risk, we're really worried about the computers you don't see. And these computers are called Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Computers, SCADA for short. And these are the tiny little computers that control our lives, that control the traffic lights in the street, the lights in the ventilation system in buildings like this, that control the network of devices in your car, from the anti-lock brakes to the entertainment system to the electric seats. All of these devices, all of these tiny little unheard of computers. And the threat that we face is not that someone will hack them and blow them up, quite the opposite. It's that these computers can be hacked and made to do the wrong thing at the wrong time with potentially catastrophic results. Now, most of us think about computer hacking as causing damage to computer systems. But we learned a couple of years ago that computer hacking is not limited to that. And the case in point was all in the news a couple of years ago. It's something called Stuxnet. What you're seeing in this photograph is a picture of the former president of Iran, Mr. Ahmadinejad, standing approximately 300 feet underground at a secret nuclear enrichment facility in Iran. And those vertical aluminum tubes next to him, those are enrichment centrifuges. If you take uranium, make uranium hexafluoride gas, and spin it long and hard, you enrich uranium from its natural state, first to an enrichment state useful for medical isotopes, and eventually, if you keep going, to weapons-grade material from which you can make a bomb. The United States and its allies knew that if you wanted to make weapons-grade material, you would need 10,000 of these centrifuges running for months at a time, even years. The Iranians claimed that they wanted to make medical isotopes, but our scientists told us that you would need about 3,000 centrifuges to satisfy the demand for those. So it was pretty clear that this was a military operation. Add to that the fact that the Iranians had taken it from the surface and over a period of months buried it 300 feet underground to protect it, the cat's pretty much out of the bag. And so during the Bush administration, a program named Olympic Games was authorized. And this program paired up our National Security Agency with the Israeli Defense Force Unit 8200, their professional hackers, to produce the world's first guided weapon computer worm. Guided weapon because it was designed specifically to attack one and only one network anywhere in the world. And once it found its way to that network, it was designed to disrupt and disable it. How did it do that? Well, through a very clever sequence of ruses, the first thing that this cyber weapon did was look around and see if it could find the computers that controlled how fast those tubes spin. And when it found that type of computer, it modified the code, the instructions on it. Then it went to sleep, and every once in a while it looked for the speed at which that tube was spinning. Because in order to enrich uranium, you have to spin the uranium hexafluoride faster and faster and faster, and when you reach a certain level of enrichment, you take that material and you move it to another centrifuge and you start again in a batchwise fashion, which is known as a cascade of enrichment. This takes months. But one thing that we knew from studying these centrifuges at Oak Ridge National Laboratory was that they had a fairly narrow range in which they would run reliably. And so when we found the right speed had been reached, the code woke up and all of a sudden increased the speed of the centrifuges from their maximum speed of about 1,200 RPM to over 1,400. Held it there for a while, and then slammed the brakes on and slowed the centrifuge to only 2 revolutions per minute. The result of this, we knew, is that at high speed, the centrifuges would tear themselves apart. But if we failed to achieve that, by slamming on the brakes, we would destroy the bearings that held the centrifuge and cause the safety systems to evacuate the uranium and throw it away. Now, when you think about it, this cascade, this months-long batch of enrichment of uranium, when you get to the very end and you've just about got a product, that's the time when you want to strike and cause it all to be thrown away, because that causes the Iranians to have to start over. Now, this code was also very clever in that it knew how to hide itself. So every time one of these things broke, the Iranian experts would come to the computer and say, "What's wrong?" And the computer had code specifically in it to report, "Nothing's wrong. Everything's like you told me to be." I call that routine the "nobody in here but us chickens" routine. Now, this problem for the Iranians went on for months. And the result was that they went from having 10,000 operational centrifuges to fewer than 3,700. Eventually, they figured out that they had been hacked. And the Iranians put out a call on the internet looking for a hacker to help them clean up the systems. They offered $500,000. And within less than a day, anonymous messages popped up all over the internet, which simply said, "We don't think that your life is worth only $500,000. And the two Iranian nuclear experts who had been tapped to clean up the computers and put the systems back online met an untimely end as anonymous people rode up in Tehran beside their automobiles, on motorcycles, attached magnetic devices to the side of the car, and blew them to smithereens. The motorcycle riders were never caught. Now, this is proof that code creates physical damage, that code can be dangerous. We should have expected that there would be some blowback, and indeed, there has been blowback. Iran, through a state-sponsored group called the Aliyat al-Qadar, the Night of Power group, planted through an insider job some code at Saudi Aramco, the largest oil company in the world. Now, this was pretty rough code, but what it did was physically destroy 30,000 computers. This is not like your virus that you can just push the button on the antivirus and remove. It actually destroyed the hard drives. 30,000 computers had to be replaced. Saudi Aramco was offline. The code eventually spread to Qatar, to Razgas, where another 7,000 plus computers were destroyed. Now, as I said, this was an inside job. It was not sophisticated. Pretty quickly, we figured out what was going on. But other blowback followed. So, for instance, the Qassam cyberfighters, also sponsored by the government of Iran, started doing something called a distributed denial of service attack. This is an attack where a large number of computers launch a great many requests to a website, so many that it causes it to crash. In this case, the Iranians did something very unsophisticated. They went onto the internet and they downloaded a software kit that allows anyone to launch one of these attacks. In case you're interested, the name of that software is "It's Okay, No Problem, Bro." And it's capable of launching 70 gigabits per second at a website. Compare that to the speed of your home internet. I think you'll be impressed. If that isn't enough, and they took down a lot of banks temporarily, the Syrian Electronic Army, again supported by Assad's government, decided to go after other Western organizations. They did it even more simply. They picked up the phone and pretended to be from the organization's internet provider, explained to whoever answered the phone that there was a technical problem, and could I please have your password? When the person cooperatively divulged the password, the Syrians simply redirected all of those websites to terrorist websites in the Middle East. It only took 6 or 7 hours to correct, but hey, when someone calls you on the phone and says, "Please give me your password," what do? Now, as if it weren't enough to worry about the organized state-sponsored stuff, we also have to worry about something called hacktivism. I suspect that many of you have read about a group called Anonymous. Who are they? We don't know. They're anonymous. But what we do know is that they have their own view of what constitutes justice. And they will use the tools of hacking to try to get justice wherever they sense an injustice, and that doesn't necessarily line up with our law or our view. And so, for instance, Anonymous has been instrumental in going after ISIS and trying to take down its websites and its Twitter feeds, because the public statements from Anonymous say, we don't support people being beheaded. At the same time, they went after a law firm in San Diego, which was defending a Marine Corps sergeant who had been accused of an atrocity in Afghanistan and was about to stand for court-martial. The law firm itself was hacked, and all of its client information was divulged on the internet just because they were providing counsel as our law requires. In a more recent case, the town of Steubenville, Ohio, felt the sting of Anonymous. In that town, high school football is king. And there was reported a party at which two high school girls were sexually assaulted. Apparently, no one was being held responsible, even though there was cell phone video. Anonymous took this up as its cause, hacked the town, the police chief, the mayor, and the superintendent of schools. And at last count, the Ohio Attorney General had successfully brought charges against two of the stars of the high school football team and obstruction of justice charges against town officials. Anonymous is truly a double-edged sword, but we also have to worry about other creatively named groups, including my favorite, the Cult of the Dead Cow, all hacking for what they consider to be justice. So people often say, where are we? What can we do? Well, here are some disturbing facts. The first is that the government is powerless or nearly powerless in this fight, because unfortunately, more than 95% of all the computers in the country are in the private sector. They're not just your PC, they're the industrial computers that run refineries, that run chemical plants, that run traffic lights, that run the monitoring systems in hospitals, so forth and so on. Most PCs still run Microsoft Windows. And as my colleagues at the Defense Intelligence Agency have told me, Windows cannot be secured at any price. If you run Windows, you are vulnerable. It's a fact of the engineering. Most, or a great many, PCs still run the old version, Microsoft Windows XP. And even systems that you don't know run XP still do, like cash register systems, and like industrial control systems. And all of the support and all of the security patching for Windows XP ended in 2014. There is no more. Add to that the fact that the most popular version of Office, Office 2003, is also unsupported and unpatched. And Windows 7, which runs on many of our computers, is unsupported, but we'll get security patches for another couple of years. There are now over 75 million unique malware viruses and worms out there in the world. So if you run antivirus on your computer and you wonder why the computer is slowing down, it's because every time you download a file or access a website, your computer has to paw through those 75 million things to make sure that what you just downloaded is okay to use. And finally, the herd immunity problem persists in computers. 17% of all of the legitimate PCs in the world, not the ones running pirated software, run no protection at all. This is like saying that 17% of our population isn't vaccinated for smallpox. It's a disaster. Now, the trends aren't getting better, because more of this malware was released in 2014 than in all prior years combined. This is an exponential growth. And all of those SCADA networks, they can't just be retrofit with security. You see, they were designed at a time before we were concerned about security. And if you try to retrofit them, you break them. And so most of them have to be ripped out from the roots. Now, how do you think the mayor of Philadelphia, a very big city with a big budget deficit, felt when I told him that in order to be secure, he would have to replace all of the controllers in the water system, the sewer system, the gas system, the traffic lights? He stopped me there. He laughed. There's no way. There's not enough money in the budget, and there never will be. We, however, continue to connect our SCADA controllers to the internet for mere convenience. The first and most notable instance of this happened about 15 years ago. All rail traffic east of the Mississippi was halted for a period in excess of 12 hours. Why? Because the managers at CSX, the freight rail company, wanted to be able to check on the status of their network from wherever they were, including at home. So they controlled the rail, they connected the rail control system to the internet so they could log in. A virus infected some of their computers. And as a result, CSX, which shares the rails with Amtrak, the passenger network, was blinded. And the only way to ensure safety was to tell every train on the network to completely stop in its tracks until they could get everything cleared up. In 2003, there was a blackout in the Northeast United States, which, while not caused directly by a computer virus, was at least partially attributed to one. The blackout itself was caused by a sagging power line hitting a tree. But the reason that it spread like wildfire and blacked out the Northeast United States from its origin in Ohio was that the people sitting at the control panels were watching computer screens connected to computers that had been infected by something called the Code Red Worm. That worm merely slowed their computers down, but they couldn't trust what they were seeing on the screens, so they couldn't take rapid action to isolate the failing parts of the network. Now, you would think that there are some computer systems that are so isolated from the internet that they're not in danger at all. And my favorite example of that would be an offshore oil platform. On the other hand, offshore oil platforms are lonely places, and people tend to do some strange things, like carry those little USB memory sticks with them. And when they download some music or some things they shouldn't onto those memory sticks, they carry with them malware. And in one case, they compromised the platform to the point where the control systems could no longer control it. If the software had been programmed more maliciously, we might have seen another spill like we had in the Gulf of Mexico. And so we come back to this question. It's cyber, but is it war? And a few years ago, a general told the Wall Street Journal, "If you shut down our power grid, maybe we'll put a missile down one of your smokestacks." Now, I monitor a bunch of hacker boards, and within minutes, the answer popped up. LOLs, for those of you who don't speak hacker, that means I'm laughing at you. We have zero smokestacks, dude. It's a fundamental miscalibration of the response. We continue in this. Just last week, Secretary of Defense Carter gave a very important speech in which he laid out a new U.S. cyber strategy. The take home from that is that the U.S. now reserves the right to conduct hack-back operations against both military and civilian targets to achieve our goals. When asked why he would say this in public, the answer was, people should fear us. No one asked him, which people? Where are they? And how do we know?
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with technology consultant Lawrence Husick. Husick is the co-director of the Center for the Study of Terrorism at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. This presentation was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. It was recorded May 1st at the Hilton Anchorage.
It's been said that the overall strategy of the Pentagon just looks like a miscalibration, because what we have is the weapons of the last war aimed at the opponents of the next. Is this a serious problem? Well, the Pentagon itself told us in 2013 that an audit of our nuclear forces was inconclusive. That is, that they couldn't guarantee that if we needed to push the button, the missiles would go up, or that if they went up, they would come down in the designated places. And in order to fix this, we were told, it would require $500 million and 5 years of effort. So we can't even be sure of our most important strategic asset. Congress has been asked to get into the act and fix this problem. And every time the Senate has filibustered any attempts for the federal government to take the lead in this solution. And so the White House has been left to issue executive orders. The first to give us a cybersecurity standard to which we can all aspire through frameworks promulgated by the National Institute of Standards and Technologies. This is a best practices document, not binding on anyone. More recently, the White House has announced that if we can trace back the hacking to a particular nation state, we will freeze the financial assets of the actor. And I remind you that the most recent high-profile hack, Sony, carried out allegedly by North Korea, would have led to the freezing of exactly zero assets, since we don't have any North Korean financial assets in the United States. So what are we to expect of the future here? Well, I think it can be said without question that in any future conflict, and in all present ones, the use of cyber weaponry will be a force multiplier for everyone. We will see cyber attacks. We also know that there is no perfect security solution here, that instead of hoping to build an impenetrable wall, we're going to need to have resilience, alternative systems, substitutes and backups, and those are expensive. We also know that there is no defense doctrine based on deterrence, based on MAD, that will work, because it is almost impossible to directly and quickly attribute the source of an attack. So what do I want you to know? Well, I want you to know that cyber threats are just threats that use computers and networks, and they're like any other threat that we face. There really aren't any differences to be concerned about among cybercrime, cyberterrorism, cyber war, cyber espionage. They all use exactly the same tools and techniques, only the objectives differ. Cyber threats are highly asymmetric. That means that the person who is acting against you doesn't need expensive weaponry, just needs a laptop and a network connection. And on top of that, it's easy to do and it's fun. And this means that the threat comes from everywhere. Retaliation, at least instant retaliation with pinpoint accuracy and total fidelity, is not possible. And our private sector that runs 95% of the computing systems is not doing well. If they play catch up at all, they've been playing it badly. And so we end where I began. That is, we have been warned. In her departure speech, as the Secretary of DHS, Janet Napolitano, told us directly, that we will face a cyber attack that has a serious effect on our lives and the functioning of our economy, and we had better be prepared. And yet, we have little conversation going on between the public and private sector. We have an inadequate definition of what constitutes a serious threat to national security and a vulnerable sector. We need to demand of our government and of our business leaders that we do more. The engineering community has solutions for what it calls trusted computing. What I want is for us to demand trustworthy computing. And that means that the public and private sector work together to establish standards, to implement those standards, to make the investments that are necessary to be sure that our increasingly computer-controlled lives can be led safely and efficiently. And I'd ask all of you to join me in that call. I really look forward to your questions today.
So, thank you, I think, for a very informative and somewhat disturbing presentation. If you'll permit me, I want to ask a question from slightly out of left field, because in this cyber war, cyber terror, cyber et cetera, the ultimate progenitor of the threat is human. How long might it be, however, until the threat within the computer is generated by the software itself, if not exactly aware, autonomous? Is that something on the horizon? Is that something that anyone is really thinking about or is appropriately worried about?
An excellent question. And a question that as at its core asks, should we be worried about artificial intelligence? or put much more pop culture, how long until Skynet emerges? Of course, we can't know the true answer to that question, but I think we can take a lesson from what we know of Wall Street. On Wall Street, we have what's called high-speed trading. And high-speed trading is pre-programmed routines that execute financial transactions based upon the information that they're seeing in as close to real time as they can get it. And the result, or at least one result of this, was something called the flash crash, in which the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 1,000 points in a period of minutes because a bunch of trading bots, that's pre-programmed trading software, read the wrong signals and executed things that they were told to do. Now, anyone who's ever programmed a computer and taken basic programming knows that there is this sickening feeling when the computer does exactly what you programmed it to do and it goes horribly wrong, like when 3,000 pages spews out of your printer. Yeah, I did that. So is it conceivable that an adversary, a military, will design some software that has some smarts to it that is designed to go after other software? And the answer is absolutely that's conceivable. And so there's a tremendous focus in artificial intelligence research on systems that diagnose and repair themselves. And that's part of trusted computing. So part of trusted computing says, this thing isn't doing what I expected to do. At the very least, I ought to quarantine it. And so what we will see, I think, is an arms race. An arms race between the protective software, which will be much more sophisticated than your average antivirus is today, and the malicious software, because if you look at how the viruses and worms are being written today, it's eerily intelligent. And so I think we're already in that battle. That battle will continue and it will intensify and it will just be a part of the landscape. Excellent question, thank you.
My name is Robert Gordon. I work in IT security, but so I'm trying to hear what you're trying to say at the end of your speech. Were you advocating that the government or some other agency would have to regulate the IT industry in order to give us a trusted computing platform? And I guess kind of my bottom line of the question would be, you know, is it freedom of choice between Android, Apple, Dell, Microsoft, whatever, versus what's best in our interest, either the national security interest or security in general? Or how do you craft that message to you?
Well, as a lawyer, I can tell you that concerns about our civil liberties are always on the top of my list. And as someone who's done IT for a long time, I will tell you that I don't think that anyone has a monopoly on the great ideas. I don't think that government regulation of one platform is at all a smart thing, because a monoculture, whether that's a crop monoculture or a computing monoculture, is infinitely more vulnerable than a diverse culture. Also, I have seen private actors step to the front and take steps that not even the government would endorse. Take a look at the encryption built into the latest iPhone operating system. The director of the FBI has criticized that encryption that provides us privacy by saying that that encryption will endanger the life of a child. I think that's an irresponsible statement. And so no, I don't think that this is a government dictate kind of program. But there are architectures for doing trusted computing which should be publicized and encouraged. And those architectures have been around for quite a long time. In the 1960s, MIT developed an architecture in which a piece of software needed a certain level of authorization. There were 7 different levels. And if a piece of software tried to do something that was above its clearance, so to speak, it was referred to a piece of executive software that said, "Who are you and what do you want?" And in some cases, stopped until a human could approve it. And we see glimmers of that, although how many of us actually stop and look at the message before we just click the OK button? And so I think there are ways to do this in partnership, where the government can take the lead, The government can publicize standards coming out of private industry. Private industry can contribute by setting standards and not exercising its patent rights so as to contribute them to the public domain for the public good. I think some of this is being done now. But my counter case is the chemical industry. Because in 2002, when it was recognized that it was a ripe target for terrorist attack, the chemical industry said to the government, "Don't regulate us, we will self-regulate." And here we are 13 years later, and a great many participants in that industry have not stepped up and taken their responsibilities seriously. And there comes a time when those who would be free riders on the efforts of the others and those who would shirk that responsibility really need to be brought to heel. Because as we learned in doing some studies, you can insure an individual plant, you can insure an individual company, but when you are a participant in a global economy, you can't insure your position in the supply chain. You simply can't buy insurance for that. Early on in my research, I identified a single factory that made 80% of the world's supply of one chemical, a chemical crucial to the production of semiconductors. This plant was in a tiny town in northeastern Pennsylvania no one had ever heard of. And the plant was fully insured for its value of $10 million. It had taken every step to make sure that its neighbors would not be poisoned by this chemical if the plant blew up. They did everything right. And yet, if that plant went offline, 80% of the world semiconductor industry would be offline for more than a year. And if you think that's not serious, go look at buying a new car. Any new car that you buy, even the cheapest one, has about 25 different computer chips in it. It's even got a bus that connects them all. And so when you think of the impact on the world economy, had that particular company not stepped up to its full responsibility, it imperiled the supply chain. And those are the commons problems that are so difficult for us to solve today. If we have gridlock in government, you can imagine how bad the gridlock gets when not even the industry can agree. And so I'm advocating that we have some tougher standards, that we have some aspirational standards, and mostly that we have an open discussion of what our responsibilities are to each other as we use this technology. Great question, thank you.
Thank you very much. My question is kind of at the other end of the whole technology thing. What kind of conversation and discussion is going on with protecting the hardware from, you know, I mean, the scenarios, an EMP or a solar flare, that kind of thing. But I'm just curious as to the direction and progress of the conversation in protecting satellites, hardware here on Earth, that kind of thing.
So for those of you who don't know what EMP that is, that's an electromagnetic pulse. And it would be created by a weapon designed to mimic an intense solar flare. Back in the 1850s, before we all had electric lights and telephones and solid state devices, there was an intense solar flare, and it has been calculated that if we were to see the same intensity today, among other things, the US power grid would be offline, you'd be in the dark for about 18 months. That's how serious the problem is. Now, are we taking some steps? Yes. Are they sufficient? No, they're not. Why? Well, among other things, we have the same private sector problem as in other areas. You see, we've deregulated the power grid. It's now completely run as a private enterprise, profit-driven. And if you want to be able to recover from such an event, that means you need to have spare parts that you've already put in places where you can get at them. And the most important spare part for our power grid would be gigantic transformers, which used to be made in the United States and are no longer, and which are fantastically expensive and also difficult to transport. They're so big you can't transport them by air. You've got to do it by rail, by barge, by ocean-going ship, and so forth. And the fact is that our operators of our electric utilities don't want to spend the money to have all the spare parts in place. Because after all, that's money that you spend that then sits there and you may never need those parts. It reduces shareholder profits. And so we are faced with a system in which the amount of redundancy and backup in our critical infrastructure has been bled off in favor of additional profit for the shareholders. This problem is endemic not only to the grid, it's also in telecommunications networks, transportation networks, you name it. And so I am not confident that we are doing near enough to have the resiliency that I talked about, because unfortunately, there is no way to fully protect all of our systems. By the way, if you would like to be protected against the eventuality of EMP, you should find yourself a cell phone that operates on vacuum tubes, because they are immune and the chips will go down. Thank you.
Yeah, just curious what your thoughts are on AI.
I like it. I participated in a program that the Philadelphia World Affairs Council put on in February, which, among other things, considered the question, is 21st century technology a blessing or will it be the death of us all? And one of the questions we frequently hear is, will the computers get so intelligent that they decide they don't need us anymore and they'll wipe us out? Well, fortunately, I've been working with AI for a great many years, and I have to tell you that not only are we a long way from artificial intelligence, real intelligence is really scarce too. And so I am not at all worried about these dread scenarios of AI, but I am willing to say that we need to be in a position where we put thought and forethought into how we design these systems and how they're governed. And for that, I will refer you to Isaac Asimov and his laws of robotics, because the laws of robotics are still the best guide that we have to a, well, call it four commandments for AI. If we design carefully, if we consider that, if we think before we act, as is my institute's motto, we might have a better chance at having a good experience with all of AI. The technology is morally neutral, and that means that it's up to us who have a moral sensibility to guide its use and construct it properly. But no, I'm not worried about it waking up and deciding it no longer needs me one morning.
Hi. I noticed in your speech you mentioned China a lot. And I noticed that China has many extreme regulations set on the information that it allows its people to witness, like the Tank Man in Tiananmen Square. And it poses one of the greatest threats in cyber hacking to America. America, on the other hand, is relatively open in the information that it allows its people to see, and compared to China, it's relatively vulnerable to cyber attacks. I guess what I'm asking is, do you think countries that have more regulations on the information that it allows its people to see, do you believe they're more vulnerable, or I guess?
It's a great question. We all know that China regulates the internet with something called the Great Firewall of China. What that means is that if you are in China, there's certain information that you will not be able to see, that it will be filtered, that your searches will fail. And the Chinese, by the way, have developed all sorts of ways of talking about things that are indirect so that the Great Firewall won't see what they're asking. And so they refer to things by their dates, they refer to them by indirect names and so forth to get around it. I don't think there's any correlation between the control that is exercised by a nation on what its citizens can see and either its vulnerability or its danger to the rest of the world in terms of cyber capability. I do think that there's a danger to authoritarian regimes that try to restrict access to information on the internet, because it is a given of the internet that information wants to be free. And that doesn't mean low cost. It means that information wants to travel everywhere, and it will find its way in everywhere. And that's a danger to authoritarian regimes, and they know it. Now, the danger from the Chinese side is that the Chinese told us long ago that they would deploy cyber weaponry in a war with the United States and with the West. What we didn't understand was that war also meant economic war. And so we face these dangers because the Chinese are trying to win economically. They are fundamentally a mercantile nation. They are exercising all of their capabilities in an effort to catch up and then surpass. And militarily, as well as in the commercial sphere, they gather vast amounts of information. I don't know how many of you saw the movie Argo, but there was a scene in that movie after the takeover of the U.S. Embassy when the U.S. personnel had shredded all of the documents, when they brought in hundreds of people, mostly children, to try to take all the strips of paper and reassemble them to learn the secrets. Well, today in China, there are facilities that do that in a cyber sense. The Chinese vacuum up all of the information that they can find on the public internet and correlate it with all of the information that they can steal through their cyber weaponry. And if you take enough information and weave it together, it creates an interesting story, a story that may, in fact, have been classified in the first place. And they are expert at this. And so they gather information everywhere, from every source, all the time. And they use it to great advantage because there is no difference in the Chinese society between the national interest and the mercantile interest. And so we see that they hack law firms because law firms have commercial data as they represent clients who are trying to negotiate on the world stage against Chinese concerns. And all of a sudden, those Western companies lose out in the negotiation because what the Chinese learned was their entire negotiating strategy. These cases have been documented, and I think they will continue. And there's something for us to be concerned about and to take action against.
It seems like the problem is so huge it can't all be fixed. But suppose the next president appoints you as the czar of the cyber threat.
Oh, I hope not.
But I'm just building up to the question. Suppose our goal becomes, how can we reduce the threat by 10%? Can you outline four or five quick, immediate fixes, maybe not quick, but definite fixes? What are they, and what are the obstacles to instituting these immediate responses to make it a little safer?
Wonderful question. I'll give you one that I think would reduce the threat by 20%, and interestingly and perhaps unexpectedly would serve the business interests of one of our largest corporations. For any software company, one of the greatest expenses is something called platform fragmentation. That means that not all of your customers are using the latest and greatest stuff. So, Microsoft faces this problem in spades. What if Microsoft were to become convinced that what it should do is engineer the next version of Windows so that it will run on older hardware that all of us already own, and then that it would give it away for free, provided that we would allow the software to make sure that we could no longer run the old vulnerable versions? Think this is impossible? Apple did exactly the same thing, and adoption of their latest platform is well over 85%. It reduces the costs to the technology company in the future. It reduces the threat to us all. It would probably take care of 20 to 30% of the threat right away, without any government action, without anything more than a willingness on the part of the company to violate really the first rule of a computer company, which is that my new software never requires a less powerful computer than my old software, so that you'll have to go buy a new computer. Just once, we ought to step back. That alone would really help.
Hi. As nations such as China become better and better at hacking and cyber warfare and whatnot, do you see the possibility of the U.S. military moving away from using unmanned drone strikes or trying to push even harder to make them to implement AI possibly within those unmanned drones?
Ah, wonderful question, because UAVs, drones, represent what many of us think of as the next evolution of warfighting. And they are so attractive to the warfighter that I don't think we'll ever go back and stop using them, although we may change doctrine slightly. Today, finally, what we've done is to make sure that our satellite links to and from our UAVs are encrypted. For a long while, they weren't. All it took was a $20 piece of software in a satellite dish, and you could intercept all of the communications. They were in the clear. Now they're encrypted, at least. We have put some fail-safe systems, some nav systems in the drones that are capable of doing things like defeating the GPS spoofing that brought one down in Iran a few years ago. So we're slowly learning the lessons of using this new kind of capability. Do I think that we'll build ones that are fully autonomous? No, I don't. I think there are serious moral warfighting questions about doing that. We've seen in the last couple of weeks that often we don't know who we're killing when we deploy a weapon from a UAV. If we can't know who we're killing, that renders the legal basis upon which we use these weapons very suspect. And my own organization just finished running a conference on the moral dilemmas of warfare. I don't think there is a really good defense of deploying a weapon against a target in such a targeted fashion when you can't know with some certainty who the target is. And so I think that there will be great pushback. Now, that having been said, there will be autonomous systems that are capable of taking a drone, letting it take off, letting it go to a pre-selected loiter point, returning it from that point without human intervention, because after all, we let airline pilots rely on computers to fly as well. Right? You don't necessarily need a human in those endless boring hours of drilling holes in the sky. But when it comes to putting steel on target, I don't think we'll go AI with that at any time in the near future. I think that the serious professional warfighter would question that as much as the technologists behind the UAVs.
Very good.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with technology consultant Lawrence Husick. This presentation was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. It was recorded May 1st at the Hilton Anchorage. If you want to click through Husick's PowerPoint presentation, you can find it on our website at alaskapublic.org. For more talks like this one, you can find podcasts from all Alaska World Affairs Council lectures in iTunes and on alaskapublic.org. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. Until next week, I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.